stick it in your ear.
All right.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
People inside and out, where you at? You're listening to On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. As always, we are really grateful and excited to be able to join you today for a powerful show. And we are also grateful to be able to go into the prison cells and to the prison gates, through the prison gates, and obviously to be able to have you listen to what we have to say today. Again, a very exciting show today. It's really, really cold out to some degree, but we're grateful and excited to be alive, to be able to stay in advocacy and activist mode, representing the issues that are most important to you. So to all of those who remain behind the prison gates and walls, we obviously lift you up. Harmony, how are you feeling this morning?
Good day, everyone. How is everybody doing? I'm cold, but other than that, all is well. To everybody that's inside and outside, we are just shouting you out this morning. Special shout out to my women, Bedford, Taconic, Rikers, Horizons, and Crossroads, and all the way upstate at Avion. Shout out to all of you guys. Thank you so much for joining us. We always appreciate your presence. Molly, what about you?
I am also freezing. It is cold out there. I believe it's about single digits. But otherwise, I'm happy. I'm great. I'm excited for our show. And I'm really looking forward to the concept that we're going to discuss today.
Well, as always, we have a wonderful guest joining us today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, apologies for the technical difficulties. You know, Zoom has become a real dear friend of ours and sometimes an adversary. And us trying to navigate Zoom, so apologies for the technical difficulties. But today's show is really dedicated to really looking at trauma and witnessing trauma or witnessing violence occur in prison and the impact that that has, the traumatic impact that it has on people that are incarcerated. And fairly recently, back in December 2nd, 2020, the Prison Policy Initiative had written an article, particularly Emily Widra had written an article called No Escape, Trauma of Witnessing Violence in Prison. It was a recent study of recently incarcerated people finds that witnessing violence is a frequent and traumatizing experience in prison. And we were fortunate as we read this, article, you know, we do research, we dig and try to identify who is the author of the kind of research. And as we dug, we discovered Dr. Megan Novisky, who was the author of that work and the researcher that began to look at that. And we're really excited to have Dr. Novisky join today. Dr. Novisky is an assistant professor of criminology at Cleveland State University. Her research really investigates the links between incarceration and health and how conditions of confinement structure health disparities. Her recent research has been published in outlets including Criminology, Victims and Offenders, and the Journal of Correctional Healthcare. In response to COVID-19, Dr. Novisky has written national and local op-eds about the health-related implications of incarceration during the pandemic. She has also partnered with the ACLU of Ohio by drafting expert declarations to urge release or transfer of vulnerable incarcerated adults in Ohio's prisons and jails. These declarations were cited in briefs before the Supreme Court of the United States, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and the United States District Court for the Northern District of Ohio. Dr. Novisky, thank you so much for joining us on the count. How are you feeling today?
Thank you so much for having me, and I'll join in with everyone else. It is cold here in Ohio, but the sun's shining, so that I'll take that.
Absolutely. And we really want to jump right into it, Dr. Novisky. You have conducted research to look at the impact of witnessing violence on people that are incarcerated. So I want to get a little historical context about that and then like talk about that today. But equally important, later on, talk a little about COVID-19. And its impact on people in prisons and jails. So can you give our listeners some historical context, Dr. Novisky?
Sure. So this study was conducted between 2017 and 2018. And I had done some research before then, primarily focusing on difficulties men and women who are incarcerated face accessing medical services and some of the hardships that that's created. And my research interviews at that time were focused on interviewing people while they were incarcerated. And I really decided for my next study that I wanted to interview people as they were leaving prison instead of while they were incarcerated to see, you know, if anything else came up or if they were more willing to talk about potentially sensitive subjects. And that led to this study about violence exposure. And so I interviewed both men and women, my colleague and I did, within a year after they had left prison. And there were just these overwhelming stories about witnessing violence, anything ranging from physical assault to homicide. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking to men and women about those incidents and how it was being processed by them post-release. And so we had, you know, conversations about that. And as a criminologist, you know, this is concerning to me from the standpoint of risks for criminal behavior, firstly. So there's a couple of theories. I don't want to bore the audience too much with getting too much in the academic realm, but basically if people are regularly witnessing violence, then according to a theory called social learning theory, they may be more likely to replicate or mimic that. So think about the idea of monkey see, monkey do. So you see violence a lot and that becomes normalized, and then you can become at risk for repeating those behaviors. And additionally to that, and I like that you mentioned trauma, another theory questions when people are exposed to trauma or just stressful life events in an ongoing manner, it leads to difficult emotions like frustration, desperation, anger, things like that. And a coping mechanism can be antisocial or criminal behavior, including violence. So from the standpoint of criminology, there's the risk of, you know, prisons and jails becoming more violent spaces, and then that those patterns continuing post-release. But also just from a human rights standpoint, that's kind of where I come at things firstly, for the most part, is, you know, how is this impacting the lives of these individuals who are living in these spaces? And then how is it creating barriers or hardships for them as they're transitioning back to communities? So that's kind of how the study came together and kind of my motivation for it. So I don't know if you had any follow-up questions about that.
No, it's really interesting, right? The theories that are out there relative to that from a criminologist perspective. But then from a sociologist perspective, right, this idea of like people's environment influence them a certain way, right? And so we talk about the incarcerated experience, Dr. Novitzky, but let's talk about the environmental conditions before people even go to prison, right? People are coming from communities, right, that are under-resourced, right, that are under-supported, right, that are impacted by structural and institutional racism, for example. And so as you have an environment of a deprived environment, people don't have adequate resources, et cetera, right? It may portend like failure, right, in their functionality in the space and systems, et cetera. So do you think there's a correlation between that, right? Our executive producer who we speak about posthumously, Eddie Ellis, and others created something that was called the non-traditional analyses to criminal and social justice. And in that analysis, they talk about something that's called crime generative factors, underemployment, lack of proper housing, proper health care, all those kind of things are crime generative factors, right, that creates a crime generative attitude, right? Is there a relationship with all that? Does that make sense and jive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think what you're talking about is this idea of disadvantage on top of disadvantage on top of disadvantage. So you start many of these individuals are coming from communities where they're already under-resourced and they're dealing with systemic racism, and they already have histories of violence exposure or personal victimization. And then they're incarcerated and they're exposed to that even further. And what does that do to a person over time? And how does that make it more and more difficult for them to lead a life that gives them kind of, you know, equal or reasonable chances to contribute to society, to live pro-social values, to be happy and healthy, all of those things?
Absolutely. So as you conducted this body of research, Dr. Novitzky, you obviously had your findings. You realized that people were being traumatized by that. And so this constant exposure to the violence, it's not necessarily, I don't know, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Novitzky, not necessarily incarcerated person versus incarcerated person in terms of the violence, although that's real too, but correctional officers of violence against people that are incarcerated, right? Because there's a huge push now, right, in New York State, in New York City now, where people are, we're looking to make sure that body camera legislation is passed so that correctional officers are not like practicing abuse and are involved in brutality. Talk a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that is so important. And I'm a big advocate of the body camera movement within correctional facilities. I actually am, my current research project is looking at staff misconduct within correctional facilities. So oftentimes we're focused on what are the residents of prisons doing wrong, or how are they breaking the rules? And very infrequently are we looking at what are the staff doing and how are they contributing to, you know, disorder and risks within prisons and jails. So as you pointed out within this study, there were instances where it was the correctional officers who were perpetrating acts of violence. And in this other study that I'm working on now, there was instances of staff bringing in drugs, selling drugs, committing acts of physical and sexual violence, just really aggressive kind of verbal abuse and dehumanizing statements. And so I think it's incredibly important that we look at, if we really want to, you know, get at some of the causes of inhumane conditions of confinement, we need to look to the staff, in part at least, and see what changes can be made on that level to improve conditions.
Absolutely. I know Harmony has a question too, but I know that, you know, one of the reentry organizations and advocacy and policy organizations in New York City, the Fortune Society, is doing some work around body camera legislation, right? And I'm sure they'd like to reach out to you, Dr. Novitzky, to talk about your work in that relationship. Harmony?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Novitzky, again for being here. This is so exciting, daunting, but exciting. So I was thinking, right, so when I read the article, I was thinking more of, there's some things to me that happen that are violent against individuals who are inside that is not necessarily done by people, but just done, like hurry up and eat. You got 5 minutes. If you don't eat it, you throw it away, or bullpen therapy, right? So you're in the bullpen for hours upon hours, you know, with a lot of people having to use the bathroom. You know, you can see the half of their body or see them use the bathroom. Tissue is unwrapped and given, as opposed to, you know, so there's some acts of violence that is just set up in the system. Right. And then the reason why I know that so well is because I went to a prison in Maine where they didn't do that. Right. So it was a more of a flawless. Somebody was thinking about, per se, women. Right. Because I specialize in women. But thinking about the woman's continuum through the system to make it just a little bit more, not happy, but less punitive. Right. And so did you take a look at that type of static violence as well?
I didn't really in this paper, but it is something that's come up a lot in, you know, research interviews I've done over the years. And I think what you're just speaking to is how dehumanizing it is to live in a prison, and things that we don't even in the community perhaps think about, like the examples you just gave, right? You know, or you're waiting in line to call your loved one. It might be your only chance to talk to them this week. And you have, you know, an officer in the background yelling at you to hurry up and to hang up the phone. You know, you don't even get to say goodbye. Or, you know, I mean, think about COVID-19 right now. That's kind of in everybody's mind. I think that this is playing out with the COVID-19 pandemic, and just the lack of choices that these people have. I just spoke to some family members. I have a colleague, we're doing interviews with family members who have loved ones incarcerated during the pandemic. And so we're talking to them about, you know, what's that like? What's going on? You know, what are you worried about? Things like that. And a lot of people haven't got to see their loved ones in almost a year because of the lockdowns. And even just simple things like being able to step outside for a few minutes. And so you have people who have for 8, 9, 10 months haven't even seen the sunshine. You know, they're forced to live in these environments like the way you described. So I think what resonates with me with what you said is just the dehumanizing, regular, constant, you know, strain of that environment. And it doesn't, what I also like that you point out is it doesn't have to be that way. There are more humane alternatives that we see. You point out an example in Maine. We see that in European countries too, where the conditions are different.
Dr. Novitzky, talk about people who are coming in already with mental health issues, right? And are exposed to that kind of violence, right? I would imagine, right, the condition of that individual is exacerbated, right? Because the person already has some mental health issues that they obviously inherited, like grew up with, right? Owing to like the environment they were in, or just maybe just being born to the world like that. Talk a little bit about that, Dr. Novitzky.
Sure. So we know that according to the research, on average, people who are incarcerated tend to be more likely to have not only elevated physical health risks, but mental health risks, as you pointed out, Andre. So if you are coming into the facility and you already have a mental health condition, and then let's say it's post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And you come in and then you witness someone getting beaten up severely or raped or stabbed or something like that. that can be triggering to people who don't have a mental health history, right? And so for someone who does have a mental health history, does have a history of post-traumatic stress disorder, that can then trigger further deteriorations in that condition and be very anxiety and stress producing, which can make it really hard to, you know, just process the daily living that happens in the institution. And then it can lead to little things too, like, you know, you witness something like that and it's it triggers your mental health symptoms. And then the correctional officer perceives you as, you know, trying to break a rule to be difficult or to be resistant versus, no, I'm struggling with what's going on around me. And so then you get an infraction and then you're sent to solitary and then your mental health symptoms worsen even further. And it's just this horrible trajectory that happens.
And that's a really interesting like pathway that you've like kind of laid out, right? This relationship between all of that. You know, Dr. Lubisky, what are some of the interventions? Like what are some of your recommendations relative to that? Because in our next segment of our conversation, we want to dig into a little bit of COVID-19. Sure. Right. And what's happening there. So what were some of your recommendations that came out of your research around this? Because it's an incredible body of research. It has real serious like implications. Right. And validated. Right. Based on like the research and accounts that you've gotten from those who were in your study. So talk a little bit about that, Dr. Novitsky, your recommendations.
OK. And thank you for those kind words about the study. I think that some of the recommendations that are really important are, number one, you mentioned body cameras. We need to increase accountability within these institutions. And if there are staff members who are perpetrating violence or instigating it in some way, you know, somehow contributing to these acts of violence, they need to be held to account. And there needs to be solid policies in place for that to happen. And one way that you can do that is to build a culture within the correctional facility that rewards pro-social behavior and humane treatment by the staff towards the residents. And so think about promotions, for example. The people who get promoted, the people who get raises, that's based on your humane treatment of the residents and your following of the rules. And conversely, there are penalties in place if you are contributing to inhumane conditions, including violence. And body cameras can be one piece that helps with that. The other recommendation I like to throw out is just this to me, in addition to a lot of other research, great research that's being done, is further evidence that we need to use incarceration sparingly, far more sparingly than when we are, because when people are faced with these kinds of conditions, you risk making their lives worse and their risks for criminal behavior worse if you put them in these environments. So, I mean, in the US, we incarcerate way more than our comparative European countries and for far lengthier periods of time. So being more thoughtful and strategic and careful about how often we're using sentences of incarceration and reducing the lengths so that people are less likely to be exposed to these traumatic incidents. So those are two areas that I think would help.
Well, absolutely, Dr. Novitsky. Harmony?
So tell me a little bit about, so we often, many of us have seen a lot of the trauma. We have seen a lot of the collection of the data. We have seen not much change in the correctional facilities. Tell me a little bit about the people that you interviewed and what they might have or what you might have come to, aside from the things that we know are obvious. With this data, right? So now I can take this data and I can send it to Maine and I can, you know, try to mimic what Maine does. And, you know, is there a facility? Did you meet someone that is actually doing it well? Or is there someone who's taking this information, for folks that's been doing this for a really long time, taking this information and really implementing some differences for the people who have suffered this type of trauma and this type of this experience, right, in incarceration. So because it's been some great studies and it's been some great work around the research, but then, you know, like one of the girls, I met one of the young ladies recently this week, and I said something to her, and I said, we're going to get somebody to help you. And she said, we're going to get somebody to talk. She said, they can talk, but I need help.
Mm. Yeah. I like that you raised this point because, you know, we have been slow to implement necessary changes. I know we're talking about it more often lately. I feel like it's coming up more, especially at the national level. We hear criminal justice reform being thrown around a lot more in conversations, but I think there is a lag as far as implementing some of these necessary changes. In my study, I didn't come across, you know, either interviewees saying, you know, I had a positive experience here, or, you know, I didn't meet with a facility that I felt was doing, you know, kind of what you described in Maine. So this more positive environment. In Ohio, we have mostly dormitory style, you know, conditions in our facilities. And so I know one of the kind of more positive examples that I've heard has been in other countries where, for example, individuals will have keys to their rooms. I'll call them rooms, and they can come in and out almost like a hotel or like a college dorm kind of setting versus here. And at least, you know, in Ohio where, you know, people are crammed together either in a large kind of space where there's just rows and rows of bunks, or they're crammed in, there's a couple of them crammed together in a cell, and they don't have a choice of really when they're coming in and out. So even that's like one area that if you give people a little more humanity in being able to choose when they can come in and out to use the bathroom, for example, or to use the shower, those are things that sound very simple, but would be very meaningful in making people feel more like human beings. So yeah, but I like your point about, you know, it's nice to talk about it, but where's the action?
And absolutely.
Yeah. And I think you asked too, like if anything kind of stood out or whatever when I was talking to people. And one thing I want to point to in these interviews is I've been focusing so far on, you know, witnessing the violence itself. But I want to mention that something that came up in the interviews that was interesting to me and that I didn't anticipate was people talking about when they weren't even involved at all, they still had to be involved in the violence because they were put on cleanup crews, for example. So they had to be, they were the ones called in to go clean up blood, for example, after, you know, a really severe assault that occurred or a homicide that occurred. And I remember one man talking to me about how he just kept pouring bleach on the ground, and he had a mop and he was moving, you know, the mop around, and he was pouring the bleach, but he didn't want to look down because he didn't want to see the blood. And I just thought to myself, like, wow, how would that be to experience that and cope with that in your environment? And these are people that are making, you know, for that type of work, they're making 15, 20 cents an hour. So I don't know, that stood out to me a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, Dr. Nabitsky. And, you know, we want to kind of segue into like the next part of this conversation, as it relates to solitary confinement and quarantining and all that kind of stuff. But you're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. My name is Andre Ward, and I'm joined by producers Harmony and Madi. And we're in conversation with Dr. Nabitsky, who has written a report and done research and studied on the impact of witnessing violence, or people who are incarcerated witnessing violence and the impact that it has on them in terms of trauma. So we're glad that you joined us, and we hope that so far this has been very informative to you. So Dr. Novitzky, we're now in this era and period of COVID-19. This pandemic has devastated. I think the number's up to plus 400,000 deaths in this country so far. So it's impacted people tremendously in this country. For those people who are inside that are incarcerated, even more so, right? Because of the fact of not having access to this kind of supports that the general public have, the PPEs, and now on the rise, like the vaccinations, and what does that look like? But one thing I want to talk about before we get there, solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. Like, research and study show that solitary confinement in and of itself is dehumanizing, it's traumatizing in and of itself. And it's a form of violence, right, on the psychology of the human being. So talk to us about, like, solitary confinement, your thoughts on that, vis-a-vis the work you've done around witnessing violence and trauma. Because even someone seeing someone being in solitary confinement for 20 days, 30 days, 40 days, and they not coming up the cell does something to psychology. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as my just general thoughts on solitary confinement, much like incarceration, my view is that we use it far too frequently. It's something that should be used very sparingly, very rarely. But it's used, you know, very frequently in the U.S. And there are now calls to limit its use and to put upper limits as far as the length of time someone can spend in solitary confinement because of this, all of this research that's coming out about how people's physical and mental health can deteriorate when they are exposed to those kinds of conditions. And I talk with my students about this in our classes, and I tell them that the average solitary confinement cell is 6 by 9 feet, which is basically the size of a parking space. And I actually have a cutout that I use. I put a bunch of paper together, and I make a 6 by 9 foot area, and I bring it in the classroom, and I ask students if they would like to just stand in that space for a minute and kind of sit on that, think on that, what it would be like to have that be where you are living for days, weeks, months, years at a time. And so it's something that is overused, that has tremendous physical and mental health consequences. And this is an area that drastically needs reform.
So following that kind of chain of thinking in this area, Dr. Novitzky, we know that right now, many correctional institutions throughout the country, we know certainly for New York State, New York City, in terms of the jails, that they're using quarantine, like practices, right, for people who have contracted COVID-19. And quarantining folk is akin to like solitary confinement. Talk about that relationship, right? And then obviously within the context of COVID-19.
Yeah, so I mean, the danger or the fear of, you know, introducing quarantining procedures with COVID-19 is that it's going to increase exposure to these solitary confinement style living quarters. And there's some great projects being done by Dr. Bree Williams and colleagues out at in California. They have a project called the Amend Project. And one of the things that they do is they offer guidance about how to ensure that your quarantining procedures are not mimicking solitary confinement or punishment style conditions. But that can be hard to implement, especially if you don't have guidance by someone like the Amend Project. And so one of the things I've pointed out in my work is that over the next few years, I think we're going to need more research on the mental health consequences and the physical health consequences of more and more people during the COVID-19 pandemic being exposed to solitary confinement style living conditions. So it can resemble the punishment and really not see a difference depending on how the prison or jail is implementing it. If you are, you know, in a cell and you're by yourself and you have reduced access or no access to programming, to, you know, things like the phone to call your family, you can't move around much, things like that.
You can't see other people.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we're talking about COVID-19 now, Dr. Novitzky, you know, this idea, like a lot of the prisons are set up in way where it's congregate style environments for people living in dormitories, et cetera. What are some of your thoughts on that kind of setup? Because, you know, they liken jails and prisons to like a petri dish, right, for COVID-19 to flourish and grow and all that other kind of stuff. Like, what are some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the dormitory style living conditions are extremely concerning during the pandemic in particular, because what that does is essentially makes it impossible for people to socially distance. So that 6 feet rule that we've all heard about for months, you know, from the CDC, stay 6 feet apart from everybody. If you're living in a dorm with 124 people, and you've got rows of bunks lined up. Like I remember talking to one person who told me, you know, if he spread his arms out, his arm was touching the bunk next to him. So there was no 6 feet. he was wearing, and other people he was living with were wearing masks when they went to bed at night to try to protect themselves. So these large dormitory style living conditions increase risks for COVID-19 spread, like the way you described it was a petri dish, because people can't implement the social distancing that we need to see to lower risks. There's other conditions within correctional facilities that already make them high risk. So you have a lot of people crammed together, with higher than average pre-existing health conditions. 20% of our correctional population is now at least 50 years of age and up. So you have older adults who are more at risk for COVID-19. And a lot of people think about prisons and jails as, you know, kind of closed off, hidden environments, and they don't realize these are actually very fluid environments where you have people flowing in and out of the facilities every day. So 400 and some thousand correctional staff, for example, are punching in and punching out, and they're bringing into the facility whatever they're exposed to in the community. And then whatever they are exposed to in the prison or the jail, they're then bringing out to the community. So all of these factors kind of collide to make this a high risk environment.
And then again, I just want to circle back to your study, Dr. Novitzky, you know, as you're talking about people witnessing trauma, what's the relationship between people witnessing violence in prison and as a result suffering, being exposed to trauma and recidivism once they're released? Is there a relationship
there? Well, I think you can certainly draw parallels there. So if they're exposed to violence in the institution and they are traumatized by that, and then it's time for them to be released and they come out in the community. You know, I spoke to someone who really had a difficult time being around crowds of people post-release, because that was that reminded them of prison when fights would break out. And that person had to always have awareness of who was in front of them, who was behind them, who was to their side. And so when they got a job working retail, that was very difficult, and it was extremely stressful and anxiety producing to work in an environment where customers were always around. So they had a difficult time maintaining employment because that environment reminded them of these violent conditions they were exposed to in the facility. Even though violence was not happening at their job, it was almost like, you know, their body couldn't recognize the difference as far as the stress response. And that's what we see with, you know, PTSD. So I guess to kind of sum that up, if you have someone who is struggling to maintain employment because of the lingering effects of the traumatic events they were exposed to in prison, they would then be more at risk for recidivism and going back, because we know employment is one of the best protective factors as far as reducing risks for recidivism.
Absolutely, Dr. Novitzky. And I know, you know, our show is about to close at some point, but what are some of your thoughts about the future, right? Some of us are optimists. Some of us may not be as much necessarily, but you're a researcher and an academic. And it's always thinking about future too, right? And so what about your future? What about the future of things? What do you think about relative to that, to the body of research you've done?
You know, I see drops of optimism as far as the future. And I say that for a couple of reasons, one of which, when I originally started doing this research back in 2013, 2012, you know, and I was looking at understanding the experiences of older adults in prison, there was hardly any conversations about that at all. I mean, when I proposed that as a dissertation topic, my advisors were kind of like, well, are you sure you want to do that? That seems really hard. And like, there just weren't many conversations about it. And now conversations are happening a lot about the hardships that are happening among older adults who are incarcerated. And also when I have conversations with my students about these issues, I notice a lot of care and concern from them. And they're intellectually curious about how to make things better. You know, we talk about violence in prison, for example, or what's going on with COVID-19, and their response is, well, like, I don't understand why aren't people doing something to make this better? This is horrible. And so I notice a lot of care and concern from, you know, the upcoming generation of people, and I'm optimistic, and I tell them all the time, you guys need to go out and do something about this. I'm counting on you. And the fact that criminal justice reform is, you know, at the federal level of conversation as far as, you know, an agenda item, I think that gives me optimism. One area I'm worried about, I guess, is just you know, some of the lingering lack of concern that can come up from the public. It's like, it's almost like that's them and we're us out here in the community. And so I think more efforts need to be made to show people, and COVID-19 is a great example, that we're all connected and we are all a community. Just because someone's in a prison doesn't mean they're not a part of our community. And so making efforts to kind of show that link is really important.
Absolutely. Dr. Novitzky, thanks so much for taking your time out today to join us here at On the Count. Again, we really value your body of work, and we know that it will have impact and continue to impact in the future other research around witnessing violence in prison and the trauma that it produces. You'll hear from us. You're in a different state, but you'll be hearing from us, New York State folk, the city folk, really soon as we begin to look at this body camera legislative work because it's really important and there's a push for that. And to have that as a national kind of model, I think is really critical. And your obviously input could support and help that. So thanks so much again, Dr. Nowitzki, for joining us. And we look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this and I appreciate all the work you're doing here.
Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you so much. I just appreciate all of the information and thank you as well, because we use that information in order to push it forward and to show people the correlation between what's happening inside, what's happening outside, and what we could do different. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It was very informative. And I like that our listeners know people are working from the inside for them on all levels, all aspects. So thank you for your research. Thank you for your work. And thank you for your time here.
Absolutely. And I'm not done yet.
Fantastic. And we aren't either. So we'll be hearing from you again, Dr. Nowitzki. So again, you're listening to 99.5 FM, WBII. This show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. You know, as we always say in closing, don't give in, don't give out, don't give up. Stand tall in spite of it all and stay
on the count.
Have a good day, everyone.
Let's change the way we live, and let's change the way we treat each other. You see, the old way wasn't working, so it's on us to do what we gotta do to survive. And still I see no changes. Can a brother get a little peace? It's war on the streets and a war in the Middle East. Instead of war on poverty, they got a war on drugs so the police can bother me. And I ain't never did a crime I ain't have to do. But now I'm back with the facts, giving it back to you. Don't let them jack you up, back you up, crack you up, and pimp smack you up. You gotta learn to hold your own. They get jealous when they see you with your mobile phone. But tell the cops I can't touch this. I don't trust this. When they try to rush, I bust this. That's the sound number two. You say it ain't cool. But it raised no fool. And as long as I stay black, I got a stage strap. And I never get to lay back, cause I always gotta worry about the payback. Some buck that I roughed up way back, coming back after all these years. Right, tat, 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 tat.
That's the way it is.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
Never change.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard On the Count. After a little station business, you'll hear From the Streets with Bob Law at 11 a.m. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Margaret Flowers with Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed. Clearing the Fog is a radio program that you'll hear on WBAI, Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM in New York City on Tuesday mornings at 11 a.m. And on Clearing the Fog, I interview activists, authors, journalists, academics about what's going on in the social movements and what is the reality that you're not going to hear on a corporate sponsored radio station. These are people that dig into the facts to let you know without the corporate spin how things are actually going and what you're not being told by the corporate media. And Clearing the Fog is so fortunate to be a regular show now on WBAI so that you can hear this content that you won't hear in other places, certainly not on commercial radio. So please value WBAI. Running a radio station is not something that can be done for free. WBAI doesn't have these corporate sponsors that give it, you know, large amounts of money. It's really driven by you. It's independent. It's listener supported. And that money is needed each month to keep the doors open to the station, to keep the equipment functioning, to keep, you know, a few staff who can keep that radio station going. The people who host the programs are not getting paid to host these programs. We do it because it's a labor of love, but there does have to be staff who can keep that radio station going. And that's what the wonderful folks at WBAI do. So please support WBAI by going to WBAI.org and making a donation today. Thank you.
You're listening to WBAI New York. I'm Celeste Katz Marston. This is New York in Crisis, WBAI's coronavirus diary.
My name is Denise. I live in Brooklyn, and I am a professional nanny and also a part-time home attendant. Oh, my God. It has been a roller coaster. My home attendant job, I still do. I have not stopped working that job. I've worked throughout the pandemic. Even when they had the shelter in place, I worked. Unlike my nanny job, that job, my family, they moved up to Boston, Massachusetts, to their other home. And they've been there since March, and they won't be back in the city until September, hopefully. I have to eat. I have a daughter who is in college, so I have to go to work and to provide basic food and to pay housing, which we know is very expensive in New York City. I've protected myself. I got myself personal protective gear. I just dealt with it head on. I mean, I followed all the CDC guidelines, what they were saying that we should do. I just followed it. And I'm like, I have to work, put myself in the frame of mind that this will be over at some point. It's going to go back to some sort of normalcy in the near future. So I just put on my brave face and I just do what I had to do. My family, they were paying me from the time they left, but then now they have to find other babysitting needs up where they are in Boston. So that kind of cut back on what they were giving me, even if it was part-time. So now it puts me in a situation where I'm in a tight spot where my budget is like, I'll be like living like dollar to dollar like every week. So it's hard. It's a lot of stress, but I'm somebody, I always look at the positive sides of things. Always look at the positive because I know at some point we're going to rise from this depression that's going on now. So I'm just dealing with it one day at a time, taking it in strides, meditating, breathing. I've spoken to many nannies, and I'm also a member of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And a lot of workers have been affected by the pandemic. Some majority of workers I know, they're not working because their families have moved either to Long Island. Some of them have moved out of the city completely. And those workers have been left without work. Some, their employers are telling them if they don't come to work, they don't get paid. And it's a lot to do with them not being documented. So they use that as their bargaining tool to get them to come to work. It's very hard. And NDWA is trying to, we've been speaking with legislators so that we could get the National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights passed. Because a lot of workers have no rights, no benefits because they're undocumented. So hopefully with this pandemic right now, I'm hoping to see a change in legislation concerning all of us domestic workers. A year from now, I really do believe that things are going to be way better with domestic workers because now that we have become essential, it now puts us out there as to we are now able to bargain better for better pay because, as we know, the minimum wage in New York is $15. But then really and truly, nobody could survive on a $15 minimum wage. So I do believe at the end of the pandemic, I think a lot will change when it comes to the way we have been treated by some of the employers. I think that's going to change. It's going to take a whole 362.
Denise Frederick is a nanny and home attendant who lives in Brooklyn. Stay tuned for more installments of New York in Crisis, WBAI's Coronavirus Diary, and for the latest news and updates on COVID-19.
Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll
traveling around New York City, one sees many people wearing masks, but others running or on bikes or just walking down the street aren't wearing them. Some not wearing masks try to avoid people. They walk around mask wearers, and still others wearing masks have them down below their noses. And, of course, New York City is nothing like Ocean City, where thousands without masks crowd boardwalks and beaches. But here in New York City, those not wearing masks or wearing masks improperly are worrisome. Can't think they don't care, but cavalier attitudes regarding masks put some of us on edge. Maybe they didn't get the message from New York officials that masks are to protect others. Activist Ajamu Baraka tweets, self-indulgent narcissism equals USA. Governor Andrew Cuomo says there's no legitimate rational explanation.
Well, I don't like the way it looks. You know what? Paint something on the mask, right? Get a new color. You know, you can get a designer mask. The opposition is so trivial and nonsensical relative to the risk. You could get sick. You could make somebody else sick. Even if you think you're a Superman or Superwoman, you could bring the virus home and get someone sick and it winds up killing them.
Here at WBAI, you can get one of those interesting face masks. We've created masks which show the value of our radio station, WBAI, and show that we value others. The masks are 100% cotton. They're available in white or black. For a contribution of $35, it gets you a WBAI face mask with our logo and the saying, keep free speech radio alive. Please call 516-620-3602 and ask for a WBAI face mask. For a contribution of
$35, 516-620-3602, or go to the WBAI donation website, give2wbai.org, and order a WBAI logo face mask, and you'll help us pay for this listener-sponsored free speech radio station, WBAI New York. Thank you for your support.
This is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York.